Welcome to the Digital Academy of Behavioral Economics podcast, where we delve into the fascinating world of behavioral design. Leading our journey is Gerhard Fehr, a distinguished delegate of the Fehr Advice and Partners Board. Fehr Advice is a leading consultancy specializing in behavioral economics, creating sustainable business solutions through evidence-based insights into human behavior. Gerhard, an applied behavioral economist and behavioral designer, is renowned for his innovative approach to solving complex problems. In each episode, he invites a diverse array of guests from the fields of science and business to engage in thought-provoking conversations that bridge theory and practice. With a personal mission to inspire and foster an experimental mindset in business and politics, Gerhard creates a platform for exploration and discovery. Prepare to be enlightened and inspired.
Welcome to Uncovering Blind Spots, the podcast where we explore the hidden aspects of human behavior and decision making. I'm your host, and today we have the pleasure of speaking with a very special guest. Cass Sandstein, Harvard Law professor and one of the most influential thinkers in behavioral economics and public policy. Cass is widely known for his groundbreaking work on nudging, which has transformed how governments, organizations, and individuals approach decision-making. Today, however, focusing on his latest book, Look Again, The Power of Noticing, What Was Always There. This book sheds light on how we often miss the important signals in our environment and how becoming more mindful, what we overlook, can unlock new ways of thinking and acting, both individually but also collectively. Cass, I'm very thrilled to have you here with us today. Welcome to the podcast.
It's a thrill to be here. What you do is amazing for the world, and I'm very grateful to get to be part of it.
Great. So I will take over. My name is Katharina Kaiser von der Rach. I am an experienced behavioral economist and have a strong background in consulting and behavioral design, working at Fehr Advice and Partners, where I focus on applying behavioral insights to solve complex challenges of our clients. Speaking of challenges, I am also the mother of two, so I bring my professional expertise and personal experiences to work. As a co-host of this podcast, I'm very glad and honored to welcome you here, Professor Sandstein. And before we head right into the in-depth questions on your work, as Gerhard introduced, I'd love to play a little game with you. No worries. We didn't warn you beforehand. That's intentional. The game is called the word wrap, and it works as follows. I will provide you with two options, and your task is to quickly choose one of the two options. No overthinking, no right or wrong. Let's say I say apple or banana, and you answer apple or banana, obviously. The goal is to tap right into your intuitive responses for our listeners to get to know you a little bit better. And of course, as always, to collect data so we can later on identify your behavioral profile and come back to you about it. So if you're ready, let's dive in and see what your choices reveal. We start with easy ones. Fish or meat?
Fish.
Coffee or tea?
Coffee.
I like that one. I prefer coffee too. Sea or mountains?
Sea.
Books or movies?
Books.
Morning person or night owl?
Morning for sure.
Awesome. City life or country life?
Country.
Staycation or exploration?
Staycation.
I knew that from your book. Planning or spontaneity?
Planning.
Car or bicycle?
Car.
Nudge or sludge?
Nudge.
Of course. What else? Default or active choice?
Default.
Okay. Choice architecture or no architecture?
Choice architecture. It's inevitable.
Liberation, paternalism, or full autonomy? It gets a little bit harder now.
Well, if I had to choose, I'd choose autonomy, but it depends on the context.
Makes sense. Loss aversion or risk tolerance?
Risk tolerance.
Transparency or obfuscation?
Oh, transparency.
Behavioral economics or classical economics?
Behavioral economics.
Positive reinforcement or punishment?
Positive reinforcement.
Short-term gains or long-term investments?
Long-term investments, he said reluctantly.
Individual incentives or collective rewards?
Individual incentives.
Cognitive load or simplicity?
Simplicity.
I like that one. Status quo bias or exploration?
Exploration.
Mm-hmm. Behavioral flexibility or consistency?
Hard to say in the abstract. If I had to choose one, I'd say flexibility.
Mm-hmm. Automatic enrollment or opt-in?
Automatic enrollment. Depends, of course, on what it's for, but automatic enrollment in something where you give all your money to the least effective charity wouldn't be a very good idea. But in the abstract, automatic enrollment.
That's true. It all depends on the context. Public good or private interest?
Public good.
Social proof or independent thinking?
Independent thinking.
Friction or flow?
Flow.
We are almost there. Altruism or self-interest?
Altruism.
System one thinking or system two thinking?
System two, exclamation point.
Anchoring effect or free thinking?
Free thinking.
It was the last one. Yay, we are through. Thank you very much for revealing your preferences on this one. And I will hand over to Gerhard and we dive deep into
Thanks.
Look Again.
Cass, I read your book. It was more or less a journey that you gave to me of my last 52 or 53 years on this planet. All chapters have been very relevant to me. I have two children, 11 and 14, and we are really fighting on lying and honesty. You were talking about experiments. You talk about discrimination and almost about everything which is important in our society in this book. My first question to you is, why, Cass, do you think we often fail to notice key signals in our environment? And what can we do to become more aware of the things we are missing? I know that this is part of the book, but maybe we can start on this general question and then dive further in.
Thank you for that. So human beings share this with all living creatures, a tendency to habituate. So our great-great-great-great-grandparents, so you and I are related, our distant ancestors habituated. That is to say, they moved when things change, but when things stayed constant, they were stationary. I'm talking now about unicellular organisms. So these aren't human beings or even cats and dogs or apes. And so the fact that we don't notice things is a product of the fact that we get used to things that don't change. So if you go to Berlin, as I've been lucky enough to do on many occasions, when you're there, you are amazed by the history, by the architecture, by the vibrancy, by the people, and it's just stunning. And then to see people who live in Berlin more or less taking it for granted is a little surprising to a newcomer who says, it's Berlin. But that's just how we are. Once we've lived in a place, Berlin, I'm in Washington, D.C. right now, and I landed in an airplane yesterday, and I barely noticed the amazingness of Washington, D.C. It's because I live here much of the time, and that's habituation.
So, but at the core of your book, Cass, you're talking about habituation on the one side, but the solutions that you have is to start to make breaks, to look at the things in other ways. And when I finished the book, I came to the conclusion when I was discussing this with my wife, which is a philosopher, she said, I mean, what Katz is doing, he's talking about another habituation we haven't yet really introduced in our society. It's meaning exactly this kind of things, noticing. And this is maybe the second question. Why is noticing not a habit? why it is so difficult to do it, and then we can maybe go into it. How can we make it a habit, not only on the individual level, but also on the societal level or on the company level?
Okay, so let's maybe start very primitive. So if you're going to an ocean to swim, you might notice, if you're like most people, the coldness of the water in the first moments, and your skin will be rebellious against the cold. But as you keep at it, the cold will recede and you will habituate to the temperature. And after maybe 2 minutes or less, you'll tell your friends and maybe your spouse, come on in, the water's fine. And you won't even be able to have complete clarity about how terrible it's going to be for the first seconds. So that's about noticing cold. And if you go to a place on vacation where, let's say, it's sunny and beautiful and there's great things to do, the first day and the second day will be absolutely spectacular. And the third and fourth day will be very good, but they won't be absolutely spectacular. And that's because the vividness of the vacation spot recedes as they become something that we've seen over and over again. So this is hardwired in all living creatures, that as things stay constant, we stop seeing them. And this works for, there are many pathways to habituation. One was found in Vienna, actually, a long, long time ago, whereas if you stare at a cloud of colors and there's a, like something you can stare at in the middle that's like a T or a cross, if you keep your head stationary and keep looking at the thing in the middle, the colors will recede. They'll all turn gray. And it's not until you turn your head that you start seeing the colors again. That's a metaphor. It might even be a metaphor for marriage, since you mentioned your spouse. So people who have been married for a while, if all things go well, they love their spouse, but they're not startled by their spouse anymore. Their spouse is a little like a background fact that's great, but it doesn't produce a feeling of, oh my gosh, this is thrilling. And there's nothing wrong with that. To get used to things is kind of on evolutionary grounds favored. If things are stable, and then we're probably not at risk and we shouldn't be on the alert so much, or we're not likely to find someone who can find, give us children for male or female. And that means we're kind of steady as she goes. And so there are good Darwinian reasons for not noticing. And that's just how it is. But as your question suggests, and maybe we'll just plant a flag, not to notice the amazingness of what all of us have in our life. It might be a job, it might be a friend, it might be a spouse, it might be a kid, it might be a parent. And as we talk, I'm thinking, I have a place in Washington, D.C. I'm renting right now. And until we started talking, it's not an amazing place compared to, you know, truly amazing places, but as the species go, it's amazing. There's a street outside, it has trees, it's pretty, there's a little restaurant nearby, and all of us have these things which are a little like the colors that turn gray because we don't turn our heads.
So in your first chapter, or I don't remember, first or second chapter, you're talking there about the midlife crisis when we are on the individual level. If you look, I mean, when I started to become, let's say, or left my teenage age with 20, the first thing I learned that life is not so easy. And the next 20 years, yeah, I learned that a lot of people say no to you. This was more or less my resilience test that I had. Yeah? And on the other side, I had a lot of, let's say, positive, let's say, effects in our society. I made career, I got to know my wife, we got children, and all these kind of things that you do. And your hypothesis is that if you start, let's say, it needs more or less 20 to 25 years that you get completely used to these kind of things, that you start to have the midlife crisis. Because we have also for data from a happy researcher from the UK, I don't remember now his name, that he had this U-curve where he says in the midlife crisis, happiness is lowest and it starts to increase. And with 70, it's on the highest peak. So if we bring these things together. So midlife crisis is more or less habituation minus, or you can say resilience minus habituation. And the more resilience that you have and the less habituation, the less you fall into this midlife crisis. Is this a formula we could set up?
Yes, this is great. So let's think about someone who's in their teenage years or young 20s. It might be terrible because, you know, the person you love doesn't love you back, or you can't get a job, or you get no's to various things, but it's not boring. So for most people who are 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, you could, you know, fall in love tomorrow. You could get an idea that's going to completely change your career. Anything can happen. So there are colors all around. It's like visiting Paris for the first time when you see this and that and you can't believe it and everything is on fire in your head. And then you see the people in Paris and they're just walking. And why are they just walking? They're in Paris. Okay, so teenagers and young people are, in some respects, they're just in Paris. And then maybe you turn 40 or 50 or 60, and it's Paris, but what else is new? So you have maybe a job, maybe a place to live that's nice that you would have been shocked to think you could get when you were 19 or 23. And you have maybe friends and family and people you get to work with who are actually nice and funny and fun. And they're not surprising you. Even though if your nerve endings were alert, they would surprise you. But they'll say something that you've heard them say, kind of something like that before, and you like it, but you're not amazed. And then you get a little depressed, maybe. All over the world, people get depressed, not because they're struggling, but because everything is boring. And it's not objectively boring. It's just they're used to it. And that's the source of the midlife crisis. This is our hypothesis around the world, and it fits the data. It also fits what we know about well-being. So there's happiness, you know, smiling. There's meaning, thinking my life is worthwhile and I'm doing something maybe contributes to society. You might think that you're contributing to society is making you particularly happy, but you feel it's meaningful. I had a friend in the government, in the US government. I asked him one day, how are you doing? When I passed him to the White House, and he said, well, in terms of happiness, it's horrible. And in terms of meaning, it's fantastic. And then he started to elaborate. He wasn't very happy, but his life was full of meaning. And I thought to myself, I'm just passing him in the corridor and I just want to know how he's doing. I don't need a book, but he wrote a little book for me. It was a good book. If you have happiness, meaning things are good, but you're, let's say, 50 years old or 55 or 60, and it's good in the same way, then it's not going to make you smile so much. And if your life is meaningful, even if you're doing the same thing, let's say you're contributing to knowledge, you're doing something, you have an academy on behavioral economics, or you're a doctor, or you're running a charitable organization, after 10 or 12 years, the even meaning gets a little boring. So we know that people care that their lives be varied and psychologically rich. And I think the fascinating thing about that is variety by definition won't get boring. So if you have a job that involves you do this on Tuesday and this on Thursday, and the two thises are different, then even if you're not happier, having more sense of a meaning, still you feel alive. And a feeling of depression or midlife crisis is often a feeling of, you know, life is dreary. Even if objectively, it really isn't.
So tell me a little bit about creativity. What is the science of creativity? What is in there? Because I regard myself as a very creative person. However, I had a personal experience the last 2 years. I took after 14 years traveling with my kids and my family, and also another look at this, at me, myself, at my family and the society. And what I felt after a certain time that I became hyper creative, because I had so many impressions and so on. And in these 14 years of being an entrepreneur, I completely lost this kind of, let's say, skill, I thought, which is a part of me. So maybe I'm very interested in this creativity.
Okay, so this is a great question. The science of creativity is at its early stages. So we know a lot, as of course you're a pioneer on this, about behavioral economics. I feel a little bit that on habituation, dishabituation, creativity, and innovation, we're a little like we were with respect to judgment and decision-making in like 1966. We're just getting going. So here's something we know about. Well, Daniel Kahneman once said, if you want to study memory, start by studying forgetfulness. So let's talk a little bit about a lack of creativity. So there are people whose minds are going in a rut. There's a path that they typically take, and they can be, you know, amazingly brilliant people, but it's that path over and over again. And we know some people, including in our field, who were like this. And maybe the first time they carved out that path, they were creative, but then it's that path over and over and over again. Maybe we'll go to two unlikely figures, Taylor Swift and Bob Dylan. For all their differences, they are determined to be different from what they formerly were. So Taylor Swift at the age of 33/34, she has an Eras tour. Who has an Eras tour when they're in their young 30s? But it's not fake. She has had Eras. So she is determined and succeeds in being country music, folk music, pop music, rock music, various. She goes on different paths. Bob Dylan, much more than that, is kind of famously Mr. Dishabituation, where he, you know, becomes the hero of the folk revival and then goes electric and then he does gospel and then he becomes country.
The Nobel Prize.
Nobel Prize. And he goes on different paths and he's very determined to, I think, more than any musician. Now, I think in business, if there are people who like they have a good idea and they're kind of creative by nature, but they go on a path after a certain number of years, that's just where they walk every day. And that means they'll be very steady at their job and they might be a really good implementer or executor, but they're not coming up with new ideas. And if you look at in various fields, let's take behavioral economics, kind of top of mind. If you look at Kahneman and Tversky and Thaler, to choose three, Kahneman came from psychology. And he introduced into eventually theories of choice and decision stuff from psychology that involved vision. So he didn't understand economics very well at all. And he said that till the day he died. And that was in a way an advantage for creativity. He came at it from a different angle. And if you think of people in business who have innovated, they had some other thing that they brought to bear. Dick Thaler, you know, he acknowledges he's not very good at math. So he wasn't going to be a standard economist of the first order. But he loved the psychological stuff and he loved Kahneman Tversky. And he introduced that into economics. And he just is by nature a very creative person, even today. And by nature, he doesn't habituate. He wants some new angle. And you can train yourself by, you know, taking time off, by reading things from another area, by learning something from a very different domain. If we think of Steve Jobs in business, he was just by nature and also by his strange career path, he was not habituated to the same way of doing laptops. He had a different perspective because he had a different orientation, different training.
So, this was now a lot of science of creativity, but jumping a little bit further in your book, you had, I like this. What can we learn from, or the, what the Swedes taught us? Because in Europe, maybe you don't know this, Swedes are very well known when they are abroad for drinking a lot. Because in Sweden, alcohol is very expensive. And this has a reason why, because it's always dark or always bright. You drink a lot when it's dark and you drink a lot when it's when it's bright. So they had to increase the prices of alcohol in a very, and so they have boats and ships where they go abroad. So we always said, what can you learn from the Swedish people? But you have another story about this, which I like very much. Yeah? It's about health, safety, risk. And it's, for me, I think it's a little bit about coordination. Maybe you can elaborate on this.
Okay, let's back up a bit and then we'll talk about the Swedes, what we can learn from them. There's a lot we can learn from them. I have just one particular thing. So if you are, let's say, a construction worker and the job has some hazard associated with it, and let's say you're involved in a construction project in Munich, the first couple of days, if you're like most people, you'll be super careful. And you won't be very amazingly good at navigating the hazards because it's your first days, but you'll be super careful. It's because it's unfamiliar to you and the risks you haven't been exposed to, and the likelihood that on the first days of your construction site, you're going to get hurt is low because you're just on the alert. Now, let's suppose it's a 6-week project. You've been there for 5 weeks. You might think that now the risks are going to go down because you really know how to handle the construction site. It might turn out to be just the opposite, that the risk goes up, not because you know less, you know more, but because you've habituated to the risk, you've experienced nothing going wrong for a while, and you're not on the alert as you were in the first week. And there's some data supportive of the idea that on construction sites, it's the later periods when people are at risk, not the former, when they're just learning, and that's counterintuitive. Okay, so what the Swedes did 1 year, in not in ancient history, is they changed the side of the road on which people drive. It was just announced, you're going to switch. Now you're going to drive on the other side of the road. And it was thought that that would be super dangerous. As you can tell from my barbaric accent, I'm American. When I go to the UK and Ireland, as I do not infrequently, I have to drive on the wrong side of the road. And I get very, very confused. And I feel I'm going to get into a crash. And to tell a country you have to switch would be, a very hazardous enterprise. And that was what was expected. But when the Swedes switched the side of the road on which people drive, actually the accident rate went significantly down. That's extremely surprising. It's weird. It shouldn't be. So how can it be that you introduce uncertainty and a feeling of disorientation on the part of basically all drivers, and then the accident rate goes down? And it's like the first day on the construction site, people were super careful, and that made accidents go down. And even now that startles me, that finding. But it's about habituation, dishabituation. For people who've been driving for a while, the level of care is high. But people aren't super nervous. They aren't thinking, they're thinking about their job. They're thinking about their family. They're thinking about politics. They're thinking, I hope, about behavioral economics. They're not thinking about, am I about to crash? But if you have to drive on the other side of the road, you're thinking, I'm about to crash all the time. And that will decrease the likelihood that you'll crash because you've dishabituated to the risks.
We can learn from the Swedish authorities that planning is important, that nudging is important, that giving the right instructions and highlighting the awareness on the day of change is important. Is this not a contradiction if you put this like on your last chapter, it's experiments in living, because experiments, at least in conventional wisdom, are perceived as risky. Most experiments fail, and we can say the Swedish, or can we say this, in Sweden, they didn't really made an experiment. Yeah? But you are proposing that we need experiments, that we can really follow the Swedish way. Maybe you can elaborate a little bit on this.
Okay, great. So our master concept is habituation, which in the behavioral world has been understudied, I suggest. So it's a little like an unexplored continent. And it's relevant to government. It's relevant, as you just said, to risk. It's relevant to our theory of like what kind of life people should lead also. So it has some philosophical implications. The book was done, I'm a law professor and I have an economics affiliation. My co-author, Tali Sharad, is a neuroscientist and she comes from studying the brain. So in terms of risk, if people are at risk, it might be because the objective circumstances are dangerous, or it might be because they've habituated, so they're not on the alert. So what the Swedish experience teaches us, if you increase objective risk in a way that gets people on the alert, then you can decrease the actual number of accidents. So one way that governments and private institutions can decrease morbidity and mortality is not to change objective circumstances, but to heighten awareness of the risk that people actually face. And that's not so unfamiliar. It's done with respect to healthy eating, with respect to swimming in dangerous areas. That's kind of a dishabituation enterprise that doesn't go by that name. So that's about health and safety. And it can also be about climate change. In some parts of the world, people have habituated, let's say, to temperature things. And that means that the risks associated with climate change are things people aren't alert to until things get really bad, like there's a hurricane or a flood. Okay, then there's the experiments at Living Point. And here the idea is that if you, you know, do the same thing over and over again, you may feel comfort, but you won't feel thrill. And if you experiment with your life by taking, let's say, a week and you go do something very different or a month or a year, then when you go back to your ordinary life, it will have colors associated with it. If people have either different focus from one year to the next or go into something different, then they will see the features of their environment that they stop noticing. So it's a little abstract. I, in the last 15 years or so, have gone into our government and then back to academic work and then into our government, back to academic work. And I must say that after being in government, my academic life, it's like it's full of the most beautiful colors you could imagine. It's got yeah. red and blue and purple and, you know, gold, and it's incredible.
So many nice people.
And the people are so nice and they're relaxed and they're a joy to deal with and they're not all upset and scared. And it's fantastic. And of course, in government, occasionally people are upset and scared. They have a big weight on them. And my own experience of academic life is, you know, it's as if I've gone to the best party ever, which is a little admittedly idiosyncratic to think of, but it seems like the best party ever, not because people are dancing and singing and throwing confetti in the air, but because I can see it as the what for me is a really great life in with the novelty that I wouldn't have if I were there for if I had been there every day. And there's an American actress who's a hero of our book, Julia Roberts, you may have heard of her, who says, was asked by the newspaper, what's a perfect day for you? And she said, well, I get up, I make breakfast for my kids, I get ready to have lunch with my husband, and then I do, and then I start to think about picking my kids up from sports practice. And then she stops herself, Julia Roberts says, and says, it's boring. But she says to the interviewer, you don't understand, because of my job, I go away and I have to do my acting. And then when I come back, it has pixie dust. It resparkles. And that we can all generate. You can even do it generating it imaginatively, as I'm doing right now as we talk. I'm not only talking about some of the great things about my academic job, but they're actually more visible to me than they were an hour ago. Thank you.
Very beautiful. So we are coming to the end. My last question here is, I don't know who it was. I read it in the book, but said life is not an experiment because the control group is missing. And I mean, when I was reading your book, I would say maybe there is a more beautiful word for this, because it's so important that you change it. And experiments is something very, let's say, control group. It's risk reducing. Clearly, it's increasing your resilience and all these kind of things. You have small learning steps and all these kind of things. But I was thinking about, couldn't there not be another more beautiful word for this kind of, let's say, changing and increasing your noticing experience in your life? Right? And maybe this can be our last exercise together in this podcast.
No, completely. So one of the hardest things about the book called Look Again, and it has the power of noticing in the subtitle, was the title. We don't love the title. It was the best we could do, but we would have liked, to your point, better words. And I think often in English, we're stuck. We don't have the right word. And there's a word in German that's perfect. No, I don't speak German, but I see the word and see the translation and the nuance that the German word will capture. And it'll be more precise than the English word, which is a little abstract. So I agree completely. And maybe we can work together to find an English word and a German word and a French and Italian word, too.
Okay. So if you, I could give you some, maybe some proposals on this, because this is, this is something I like to do and I'm very good in. So Cass, thank you very much for sharing your time and insights with us today. Your exploration, how we can look again. In German, the word is hinschauen. It's really to look at the things, reminds us that the things we fail to notice can have a profound impact on our life and decisions, and much more important for me, on our society. If we don't get this right, maybe something which can be very positive, habituation, is at the end something which is killing the most important thing in life, that we look again at the things that are important. To all our listeners, we hope today's episode has sparked curiosity and inspired you to take a step back and look again at the world around you. Are there signals you might be overlooking? How do your surroundings shape your decisions? And what can you do to be more mindful? Thank you for joining us. And until next time, stay curious and keep uncovering those blind spots. Thank you very much, Cass, for being here.
Thank you for tuning in to our exploration of behavioral design with Gerhard Fehr. We've journeyed through the nexus of science and business, gaining insights and finding inspiration from innovation. Remember, every day offers a new opportunity to apply these principles and shape a better future. Until we meet again, keep experimenting, stay curious, and drive change. To stay up to date with our latest episodes, be sure to follow the podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, consider sharing it with friends or on social media. See you in the next episode.